Good morning. The court calls United States v. Vella. Counsel for the appellant.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Daniel Conrad. I am counsel for appellant. We are here today to hear argument on two granted issues, which with the court's blessing I'd like to take in order. Firstly, whether the military judge abused his discretion in denying the defense motion to dismiss or disqualify under U.S. v. Casagar, and secondly, of course, the sufficiency of the evidence with respect to the obstruction of justice charge. So, firstly, regarding Casagar, and I'd like to argue in turn, we're making two arguments here. Firstly, that there's a procedural defect in the conduct of the hearing in this particular case, and secondly, that there is a substantive defect, more specifically, and I think this is distinguishing from Morissette, and that is the conduct of the staff judge advocate and how he managed the direction and the tactical decisions that were made in this case. Going firstly to the procedural defects and how the Casagar hearing in this particular case was conducted, we've essentially here, in brief at least, argued along the lines of United States versus North, and I don't think in the existing case law that there is much guidance with respect to how the government should conduct these hearings. In this particular case, what you have are a number of lawyers that are called, and the government puts a CID case file into evidence, but you don't have any witnesses that are called.
And wait a minute. I saw your allegation or your argument that there were no witnesses called. But the government argues that, in fact, they did call witnesses. They called Colonel Allen, Captain Neff, and Captain Rakowski. And if you go to the joint appendix, you can see that those individuals were called. So I don't understand what your argument is there. And they also introduced some affidavits.
I should have been clearer in brief there what we meant were fact witnesses. And North stands for the proposition, I believe, that when you have these Casagar hearings, the government has a high burden under Casagar. And North says that the government's got to dot every I and cross every T, and if necessary, call every single witness. And the problem when you don't do that...
Who didn't they call?
Well, for instance, Mr. Mustafa, the Iraqi that was in the Heights site, they didn't call a number of the snipers that were a part of the team. So when I say witnesses were not called, what I should have distinguished between are the lawyers.
How are they relevant to whether or not the statement was or was not shared with the covered or non-covered trial counsel?
Well, in terms of North, we're looking at two things here, direct evidentiary use and, of course, indirect evidentiary use. And part of the difficulty when they don't call those witnesses, particularly witnesses that are being interviewed by the government, and in this case by the Captain Neff and Captain Hall, who are the two lawyers on the different prosecution teams who are sharing a cubicle. So you have these witnesses that are being interviewed in the presence essentially the two different...
So your position is not only do they have to call the lawyers that were involved, they have to also call the individuals that they interviewed in their preparation for the case.
I think that our position is that they have to call the witnesses that they intend to call at trial, and I think that...
Because of the shared cubicle or just because they're witnesses they're going to call it?
Because of the burden of proof here under Casagar, this high burden, the government, it's the government's burden to demonstrate that they haven't used any direct...
Can you cite case law to the effect that any particular witness or category of witnesses has to be called in these things?
No, Your Honor, not specifically, although we are relying, obviously, on North.
You said that
multiple times, right, but I'm not...
But North, that's a general proposition.
That's how we've cited to it. Yes, sir.
If they've called the attorneys and they've testified, and if there is nothing in the record that contradicts that testimony, isn't that sufficient? I mean, what more do they need to do? I can understand your argument if there is something there that contradicts that, and you know they have a burden of going further with their proof. But when there's nothing that appears to contradict what these individuals testified happened as far as the the Chinese wall and the non-sharing of information. I understand your argument, but it seems to me to be a little speculative as to the fact that these individuals were aware, the new attorneys were aware of what the old attorneys had done in some of the privileged information.
I think it's necessarily speculative because they weren't called. We'll never know precisely whether the government's preparation of their case was colored in terms of Sergeant Vela's immunized testimony. In other words, in terms of whether the government, based on their observations of him on the witness stand, their observations, and they did in fact interview him in United States versus Sandoval, whether they have then gone back and asked those particular witnesses specific questions as to, you know, his mental state.
To be clear, are you saying those witnesses had to be called in order to determine whether there was spillage in the cubicle, or is this as a general proposition they need to call the witnesses?
I think that if this court were
Do you understand the question, just to be clear?
Sir, yeah. I believe I do understand it, and I would argue that they do, in fact, if the court were to adopt North as a proposition, if the government's going to meet that burden under Castigar, then they've got to put their case on in the Castigar hearing. Otherwise, we'll never know precisely whether there's been any spillage.
Well, it seems...
Sorry.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, why don't you turn to the second issue? You're running out of time, okay. But go ahead.
It seems to me that after all this, all you've come up with is, well, these two guys sat together, so they had to have talked. And Sandoval, which was discussed in open court anyway and waived. So what else have you got? Other than emanations and penumbras.
Well, we've got, I believe, the government having to meet its burden.
I still don't understand why the government hasn't.
And maybe that's the disconnect. From my perspective, is that I'll never precisely know.
What is it you think the government found out that they would not have otherwise found out?
Well, we know for a fact that in these companion cases, Sandoval, Hensley, and then, of course, United States versus Vela, we have an evolution in terms of their theory. Their theory is being refined. You have in Sandoval, and you see that in some of the motions here, that they are specifically changing their theory to remove people from the height site.
Was not the theory consistent with the sealed June statements?
It may very well have been, well, and that's what's interesting here, because while it may have been consistent with the sealed statements, it was inconsistent with that which, how the government prosecuted the companion cases. So there's an internal inconsistency there, but I think that the point that I'm trying to make is that while it may be consistent, the government hadn't seemed to have been compelled by that consistency, and over time, because of the immunized statements, changed their theory of how they're prosecuting the cases.
You probably want to respond to Judge Ryan now on the second issue.
The second issue, and I think
you can go back to the first on rebuttal or when you wish, but you certainly don't want to miss the opportunity to address that.
Well, to the court's point, this is probably the more compelling issue in my mind because it is distinguishing from the court's recent opinion in Morissette here, and essentially what you've got in terms of indirect use here is the staff judge advocate in this case that becomes the conduit here.
Counsel, what evidence do you have that the staff judge advocate was a conduit, and other than your theory that every witness in the world needed to be called in order for the government to meet its burden, what procedural steps do you think that the staff judge advocate should have taken that they didn't take?
Well, with the staff judge
specifically.
Yes, ma'am. And what the staff judge advocate does here is he creates a new prosecution team and he directs the file to be sealed. And notwithstanding these, which are consistent with United States versus Mapes,
and he also tells the counsel that they're not to speak with each other about the case.
And then he himself goes about, and he does that not only with some of the counsel.
You need to be more precise. He goes and does what?
Well, he has trial discussions with Major Kufall. I believe that's how it's pronounced. He's having discussions with the CID agents, and there's also some bleed over, I think, that's created by Special Agent Mitchum. He's having discussions that I think are coloring how the CID agents will interview with prospective witnesses.
What evidence do you have that he was relaying any immunized any immunized testimony to any person that shouldn't have received it? I mean, what evidence do you have that that's the case? What evidence from the Kashgar hearing is there that any of that happened, since you want to talk about this issue?
Well, he specifically, the answer is, well, he denied it. And if the staff judge advocate is going to, I use this term fairly loosely here, manipulate control. If the staff judge advocate is going to take this amount of control over the conduct of how the government is making strategic decisions, and then he denies having specifically talked about the evidentiary use, that presents a difficult problem. And when the government doesn't call any witnesses, it makes it exceptionally difficult for the defense to build a record at the Kashgar hearing.
Was there anything that prevented the defense from calling witnesses to rebut the case that the government put on?
I don't think the defense can be in a position to know which witnesses the government is going to call and which witnesses they decided not to call on the basis of any potential exposure.
Well, surely there was some theory at trial if this motion was made.
I don't know if that theory is articulated by the government in the motions hearing. But the distinguishing factor here, particularly with Morissette, is that the SJA is taking these actions willfully. I mean, he is willfully having discussions with CID agents as to the general nature of Sergeant Vaila's immunized testimony, or at least, and more broadly speaking, the defense theory. And he's also self-admittedly having discussions with, at least we know for a fact, self-admittedly, Major Kufal, who became the lead trial counsel in this case. So, unlike Morissette, you have bleed over from two particular sources, one the staff judge advocate, and also, to probably a lesser degree here, at the special agent Mitchum, who is also having these conversations with the staff judge advocate. And what also distinguishes this from Morissette, Judge Grammel was the military judge in Morissette. Judge Grammel happened to have been the military judge in United States versus Sandoval. And what Judge Grammel does is he, in Morissette, grants, and it almost appears from this court's opinion that it may have been sua sponte, a motion to disqualify the staff judge advocate in Morissette. And in United States versus Vaila, that was the relief that we specifically asked for, and I would note that I was second chair in this case. We specifically asked for the charges to be dismissed or the convening authority and staff of the advocate at all to be disqualified. Judge Grammel and Moore said, you see a trial judge who is specifically ruling from the bench that a staff judge advocate, who even in that case is making inadvertent spillage, if you will, in an abundance of caution, he is very specifically saying that a staff judge advocate can, under those circumstances, taint the proceeding, and he's granting a motion to disqualify. And I think that is a major distinction here between Morissette and Vaila, and it would have been perfectly appropriate for the military judge in this case to simply disqualify the staff judge advocate. And what I'd like to do with the remaining minutes is just briefly touch on the obstruction of justice charge. I don't think much argument is required here. It appears to me that the law is well settled here, that mere presence at the scene of an offense is not enough to lead to an aider and abettor theory, and the evidence is insufficient with respect to that charge. So if there are no further questions,
is it fair to say that a pivot point on that second issue is whether you see it all as one continuous event or whether you see it as a distinct dropping of the AK-47?
I think that,
you see what I'm asking? If it's one continuous event and viewed as a greater whole, then the AK-47 is part of everything else that's going on. But as I understand your argument, you're saying the killing occurs and then there's the AK-47 event.
There are two distinct issues with two distinct degrees of culpability and intent.
Could one view the facts in a different way? must you view it as this happened, stop, then this happened, stop, then this happened, or can you view it as one continuous event?
Not if I don't believe.
If so, why, et cetera?
Well, this was not charged. I don't believe this was charged. There was no conspiracy charge here. If you're going to ascribe different charges with different elements and different degrees of intent and culpability, then what I would suggest is no, you cannot view them as a continuous event. You've got to examine the question as to what the accused knew and what his particular intent was.
So you go to the charge sheet to answer my question. Is that your response, in effect, that it may or may not be a continuous series of events, but look how it was charged?
I think that, yes.
Do you have anything you'd like to say on the first issue or the second issue, knowing that you'll have time on rebuttal?
No, sir, not at this time.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government?
Chief Judge Baker, judges of the court, may it please the court, I'm Captain Chad Fisher, and along with Major Catherine Gallagher, who represents the United States. In this case, the government made no direct or indirect use of appellant's immunized testimony. The government followed the best practices that this court set forth in Morrison. It sealed the evidence gathered before the appellant made any immunized statements, and it separated the prosecution team for appellant's court-martial. And as a result, the appellant and the government were left in exactly the same position had appellant remained silent.
Which side of the wall was the SJA on?
Your Honor, I think that he's probably at the peak, potentially.
Looking over on both sides?
No, Your Honor. Well, I think similar to the facts in Morrissette, there was the potential, right? Because Colonel Allen, I guess you could say, in some ways supervises both teams. There was the potential for information to flow, the same way that there was in Morrissette. But I think the testimony belies that theory. So the question is not whether a conduit exists. The question is whether or not information actually passes
right
through.
I'm still asking, though, which side of the wall then did he end up on in the government's view?
I'm not sure that he ended up on either side of the wall, Your Honor. I think that
he's not familiar with anything in this case.
I think that that's correct, Your Honor.
He advised no one and reviewed no information.
Well, let's start with Captain Rykowski and Captain Young, Your Honor. Colonel Allen explicitly advised them not to discuss Sergeant Bella's testimony with either the new prosecution team or himself. So he certainly didn't receive any information from them. Now, as far as discussions with Captain Neff and Major Kufall, Colonel Allen testified explicitly, I did not have any strategy discussions with Major Kufall. He said he's an experienced trial lawyer. I had no strategy discussions other than to say it's a straightforward case. So I would submit, Your Honor, that he didn't end up on either side, and he was independent of both, which I think is what would be required of him under the court's case law. Now, just if I could, with respect, I take issue with two other facts that the appellant had mentioned. First is that witnesses were being interviewed in the cubicle that Captain Neff and Captain Hawk shared. The testimony is very clear from Captain Hawk at JA 145 that if and when he interviewed a witness in his cubicle, Captain Neff was never there, nor was Major Kufall or anybody else. So it's very clear that while they share a cubicle, and this is what the military judge found, very clear that they were vigilant in following Colonel Allen's direction not to share any testimony or to have any exposure to the immunized testimony.
Counsel, my concern in a case such as this is both Article 31, which neither side cites, and the Fifth Amendment protect a person from having to testify against himself. And this immunized testimony is a rather recent phenomenon. You won't find it in the common law, I don't believe. And the case law is developed so that the government has a huge burden of showing that nothing that was gleaned from this immunized testimony, either directly or indirectly, was used to convict Specialist Sergeant Vila. And you argue that nothing directly or indirectly was used.
Yes, Your Honor.
Absolutely. What about counsel's change of theory?
Sure, Your Honor. I can address that. I think the problem with that argument is that it presumes that the clean prosecution team was aware of the theory in Hensley and Sandoval. So they were aware of it, they saw it didn't work, and then they somehow changed, right? But the problem is that the evidence shows that they were not aware of it. I think the evidence shows that Major Kufall, Captain Neff, and Captain Young developed their theory of the case independently. And what I would submit to the court, Your Honor.
Well, Sandoval was alleged to have been present and participating in the event, wasn't he?
That was the.
And they learned from
from the appellant's testimony that he wasn't there.
Yes, Your Honor, but that's also contained within the appellant's pretrial confessions, which were sealed and made available to the clean prosecution team, which is what the clean team relied on. So what I would submit to the court, Your Honor, is that if the government's theory was anything other than Sandoval was in the pump house, then we might have a problem. The fact that it is entirely consistent with his pretrial statements, again, to me, is independent evidence, or it is the independent source, Your Honor, of the government's case.
Wouldn't the cleanest way here have been to send the, quote, sealed file over to a new convening authority in SJA and have ask them to prosecute the case?
Perhaps, Your Honor. Perhaps. I think that they could have done that.
Not perhaps, but as a matter of law, wouldn't that be the best?
No, Your Honor. I don't think as a matter of law that's required. I think the case law clearly establishes that the government's burden remains the same no matter what. The government's burden is to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that no use was made, direct or indirect, of the appellant's testimony and that they had an independent source for all their evidence. And I think the government met that goal.
Counsel, is there any way for us to find that the government made direct or indirect use of the testimony without also determining that the people that testified at the Castigar hearing lied?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think, just to follow up on that, Your Honor, I think this court said in Morris that there is no set process for these Castigar hearings. I mean, if you look at Montoya, which this court cited in Morissette, Montoya was just affidavits. There were no witnesses called at all in that case. So again, there's a spectrum here of what the government can do, and I certainly think that the government met their burden through calling witnesses, through introducing affidavits, through introducing 32 testimony, and introducing the CID file. If there are no further questions on the first issue, I'll move to the second issue. I tend to disagree here with the appellant's counsel. I don't think that this is an obstruction of justice charge. It's similar, but the line, you know, there's no elements. The elements are not entirely the same as obstruction of justice. The charge is wrongfully placing an AK-47 on the remains of Ghani Al-Janabi. And again, appellant was convicted of this offense under an aider and abettor theory.
Now, what's wrongful about it? If it's not obstruction of justice, it wasn't placed there with the intent of obstructing justice, what's wrongful about it?
It's wrongful, Your Honor, because I think it's, I mean, as a pure 134 offense, it's wrongful because it's prejudicial to good order and discipline. And
how?
Well, Your Honor, I think the idea of...
How is the manual act of placing a rifle on the dead body of a combatant or whatever you want to call him wrongful?
Well, Your Honor, I don't...
Does it violate the law of war?
No, I don't think that was the government's theory, Your Honor.
What is it? Oh, how does it violate either prong one or prong two of 134?
Very easily, Your Honor. We're not limited, again, to the simple act of placing the weapon, but again, it's the circumstances.
But what was the theory? What was the government's theory? Was it that he was obstructing justice? Was it that he was desecrating the body? What was the theory?
The theory, Your Honor, is that the planting of the weapon is an attempt to make an illegitimate kill look legitimate. And again, that is the plan all along. So the criminal venture,
But there's no conspiracy charge. How can you talk about a criminal venture when they're charged as two distinct acts?
I don't think there's any requirement, Your Honor, that the government charge both conspiracy and...
If you don't charge it as a continuous act, then we have to treat it as two separate acts, unless you have authority to the contrary. I mean, we have the serious offense of unpremeditated murder, and then we have a separate, different offense of placing a rifle, which is criminal because of Article 134, okay? There's no evidence that he had anything to do with that, so why are you pressing that?
Well, Your Honor, again, I think it comes back to the idea of what is the venture? If we define the venture as...
But where are you getting this venture from, other than from Judge Baker's question to appellant's counsel?
I'm getting it, Your Honor, from the court's case law in terms of what is required to prove aiding and abetting. I think the court has gone back to... Learned Hand's formula, I think, you know, there are a couple of different ways in which it's been phrased, but Learned Hand's formula is that in order to aid and abet another to commit a crime, it is necessary that the defendant in some sort associate himself with the venture, that he participated in it as something that he wishes to bring about.
But don't you think that venture there is in terms of, like, the act? I mean, the act of placing the gun on the person's body.
Well, Your Honor, what I would submit to the court is that this is really a two-part venture. The venture is to kill and make it look legitimate. That is the venture. And if you define it in that way, then the appellant's murder is essentially part one of a two-part plan.
And what evidence is there that he had any idea that this weapon was going to be placed on the body?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think the evidence to that effect is very strong. I think there's a lot of evidence that shows appellant's knowledge of this plan. The first is that the appellant was standing next to Sergeant Hensley as he radioed in these false radio calls. And the language, if you look at the appellant's first confession, the 24th June, he's very specific in that. He says, Sergeant Hensley called and said, I have a local national out there at 400 meters with an AK-47. Very specific. So he hears and is clearly aware that Sergeant Hensley is making these radio calls, and he's very specific that the person has an AK-47, not just a weapon.
Now, who, at that point, he's aware of who has an AK-47. Is he aware that Hensley has an AK-47, or that it's in a backpack somewhere?
Okay, I understand your question, Marigan. So there's, I think, his awareness of the plan and then whether or not he was aware that Sergeant Hensley had the AK-47. And I think there are a couple of things that show that we can infer that appellant was aware of that. The first is that I think it's just common sense that it would be difficult to hide an AK-47 amongst, it's not a small weapon. It's very difficult, I would think, to conceal this for however long they were out there a day.
Didn't Hensley testify that he didn't think that anybody knew about it other than himself and the guy who was carrying it?
Hensley did testify to that, Your Honor, but again, this is a legal sufficiency, so I think we have to draw inferences in favor of the government. And the evidence that I think supports an inference in favor of the government is, again, the common sense argument. Number two, Sergeant Hensley said that the AK-47 was in the top mat flap of a rucksack, which is not hidden under anything. It's literally on top of everything else. And the third piece of evidence, Your Honor, I would say, is that at the Supplemental Joint Appendix at page 120, Sergeant Hensley said that Sergeant Vella was responsible for getting everybody's gear prepped and making sure that everybody had packed their rucks.
Here's the problem, counsel. If you had charged this as an obstruction of justice charge, your theory of one continuous venture and him being an aider and abettor might make some sense, but that isn't what you charged him with. You charged him with placing an AK-47 by someone's body. I mean, that doesn't have all these other nuances and inferences that you're talking about now. It's not part of the charge.
That seems to be a discrete act on its own.
Mm-hmm. Just based on the way you charged it.
And I'm still lost as to how it's wrongful.
Well,
or in what context it's wrongful.
If I could address Judge Ryan's question first and then...
Please address Judge Ryan.
Your Honor, what I would suggest is, again, I think... You know, the res justi of the offense is not limited to literally just placing the weapon. I mean, we have to look at the circumstances, number one, to define the crime, and number two, to determine, as Judge Stuckey says, if it's prejudice, legal undiscipline, or
no, but what I'm saying is that you want us to say that this is all part of one continuous act. And what I'm suggesting to you is, based on what you charged him with, it's hard to see how you do that. Though I don't disagree that if you had charged him differently, it might make the theory that you're talking about would make some sense. But you're not tying together how all the things that you're saying show that he aided abetting in what you charged him with, which was placing a weapon by the person's body.
Well, Your Honor, I guess what I would make one final point in that regard, Your Honor. I would say that for the aiding and abetting, we would have to show both an act and a mental state. And the act must have assisted, and the appellant must have intended for it to assist. Right. So for the act, again, it's our theory that the murder...
So what act did he take? To place the weapon on the person's body.
Well, Your Honor, again, I think this comes back to Pritchett and all the aiding and abetting cases, right, which is you don't actually have to physically participate in the act that's charged.
Yeah, go back to the charge, though. I think you're running to race off and talk about the law, but work out from the actual charge itself and then apply the law to the charge. Do you have the charge sheet?
I do. Well, I mean, I know that the charge sheet says specifically wrongfully placing. My theory is, or our theory is, that it was the murder that aided and abetted or that instigated the planting of the AK-47.
Wait a minute. They killed him so they could plant it?
No, Your Honor. My theory is, again, this was, the plan all along was to make an illegitimate kill look legitimate.
Right, which sounds like obstruction of justice, but you say it's not.
Well, Your Honor,
so what is it?
I think there are a couple different ways it could have been charged, Your Honor. But what I would submit finally to the court is, if the court feels that the evidence is legally insufficient on this charge, I think that the court can dismiss it and still affirm the sentence, because the military judge merged the 134 spec and the 118 spec for sentencing. And that's in Appellate Exhibit 63. So I think this court can be confident that, absent any error, the sentence still would have been the same. Pending any further questions from the court?
You know, there was a famous case, and I can't remember the name of it, and neither one of you cited it, involving, maybe you remember, Judge Stuckey, the staff judge advocate of the Strategic Air Command.
Cook v. Orser?
Yeah, Cook v. Orser.
Yeah.
And neither one of you cited that case. That was a genesis of the Castigar rationale in this court. Are you familiar with the case?
A little bit, Your Honor. I think it's cited in a couple of the cases that we cited in the brief. But what I would submit, Your Honor, is that there are a couple of cases that talk about SJA. This is on the Castigar issue. There are a couple of cases that talk about SJA involvement and convening authority involvement. So, for instance, MAPES is a case that involves SJA, and convening authority. And there the court said that the SJA and the convening authority were tainted. But there are a couple of huge distinctions between MAPES and this case. Number one, in MAPES, the SJA and the convening authority were actually exposed to the immunized testimony through post-trial action and such. Here, Colonel Allen explicitly testified that they had not taken any post-trial action because for this very reason, because they didn't want to have any exposure to the immunized testimony. And Colonel Allen also testified that he explicitly advised the convening authority not to learn anything of Sergeant Bella's immunized testimony, not to read any media accounts or do anything like that. So again, the facts, I think, are extremely distinguishable from those cases in which the court has found the SJA and the convening authority caused some information or inappropriately used the immunized testimony. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Is there a rebuttal?
Yeah.
There is a brief point that I'd like to discuss with respect to the government's argument here. And this goes back to the procedural defects here, and I think this has more to do with the standard of review here. And what we have in these cases really is what I believe to be a very serious internal inconsistency here. We have the United States Supreme Court saying this is a high hurdle. And then we have a standard of review that says that, the government's burden is a preponderance of the evidence, which is perhaps the lowest form, the lowest degree of proof required in the law. And I would suggest that in terms of, because Morrissette is a case that says, look, the test is not whether the government followed best practices. And I think that with the exception of perhaps maybe Mapes, which does provide some guidance on how to create the Chinese wall, the difficulty here is that there perhaps is not enough guidance for the lower courts and perhaps the staff judge advocates. But perhaps the standard of review needs to be reconsidered in these cases to suggest that this is the highest form of constitutional burden and then to create a preponderance of the evidence standard. And then finally, the point that I would make is that the spirit of Castigar and its progeny here is that the accused should be left in the same position that he would have been had he not been immunized. So I think that if there's even one step backwards, then there has been a error of constitutional proportion, even one step. And if the court asked questions about which side of the wall Colonel Allen was on, he was on top of the wall, looking over both sides, theory. I think, and particularly his conversations with respect to how the defense is going to approach the mental health issues to attack the specific intent element of the premeditated murder, which is what this started off as, leaves Sergeant Vella at least, strategically, one step back from where he would have been had he not been immunized. And the answer here was so simple. And Judge Grammel recognized this in Morrissette. Disqualify the convening authority. And we're not even here today. That's all we asked for. So, with that.
Counsel, just as a matter of curiosity, has Congress ever enacted a statute which authorizes a convening authority to do away with the service member's Article 31 rights by immunizing him?
I apologize. I did not hear the first couple of the words of that.
I'm sorry. I'm getting old and can't speak clearly. Has Congress ever enacted a statute that allows a convening authority to take away a member's Article 31 rights and order him or her to testify by immunizing? Or is that something this court has made up? The Supreme Court's made up. Somebody's made it up. But has Congress ever authorized?
If
if I recall my reading of Castigar, and perhaps Mapes, I believe that there were originally some immunity statutes, but I couldn't say with any certainty.
Are you done, counsel?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. The court thanks both counsel. The case is now submitted, and we will stand in recess until 10:15. Thank you very much.
Court stands in recess until 10:15.